Well, I guess we just jump right in because what the fuck am I reading?
This is what I was thinking this morning. As I was lying in bed, was kind of, because we're doing this as a podcast and there's going to be an audience.
Right.
And I was thinking, you know, there are a couple of, well, probably more, but I was thinking there's a couple things this podcast could do. One could be we could talk about the narrative, or the form, or like, or we could talk about the actual book.
Right.
We could do what Cliff Notes does, probably not as well as Cliff Notes does it. Or you and I could be a two-person support group for people who read Ulysses, which might be, I don't know if that's more valuable.
I like all three.
Yeah. So.
I like all three because, you know, I think because, you know, both of us having avoided it for as long as we have, it might not be a bad idea to do a little bit of all three. Because I was struggling to get through this. I was struggling, particularly with, so apparently we've read the section Telemachus, Nestor, Proteus, Calypso, the Lotus Eaters, Hades,
you figured
Aeolus,
this-
and Laestrygonius. Or whatever.
How do you know this? Because there's only 18 sections and you just named like seven of them.
Right. Laestrygonians. The Laestrygonians. So those are the first eight sections.
So well, do you have a thing that says the sections and the numbers that pertain?
Not the numbers that it pertains to, but pretty much every time that you have that break. So,
oh, is that
like,
what that is? It's like a chapter break.
Yeah, where it's just kind of, right. That's where it switches and becomes a new section. Now,
okay.
If we were, oh, here's the other thing I realized, you know, it sometimes helps to read the back of the book. Duh. Because it says right here that it also contains page references to the 1934 edition, which are indicated in the margins. Thus, that 143 stuff we're referencing. Those are the page numbers to the 1934 edition.
Oh, okay. Mine does say that. So my issue was I was getting confused and I couldn't recreate it, but I know that different sections are going to be in different people's point of view.
Right.
And I had seen the second book, right? There are three books in 18 sections and we've gotten to the second book. And I thought the entire thing that I was reading was supposed to be from Leopold Bloom's point of view. And then afterwards I realized I'm like, no, we've switched sections.
Right.
Since then. So my bad. because I kept saying like, that doesn't, okay. Like where did he go? And like, you know, I think another thing is I'm revamping like how to read this in terms of like where I am when I read it.
Right.
Cause I started our next part a little bit. I got like a couple pages in and I'm trying to like be better about like paying attention and looking stuff up and writing like, you know, notes in the margins and stuff. And that's just hard to do on the bus.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And I'm finding it hard to, I'm finding it hard to squeeze in reading and having it make sense at lunch.
Yeah. Cause it takes a long time.
And then I get home and at the end of the day, and it's like, I have to hit the gym because it's like today it's 24 degrees here. I'm not going to run outside. I mean, I could. I have the gear to do it, but I'm just like, no. You know, so I go to the Y and run, and then I get home and make dinner and sit down to start reading, and about two pages in, I'm nodding off, even though I'm sitting. You know, so it's been tough to get through it. But no, I cribbed the sections. I took a list of the sections and a short description of when they start off of Spark Notes. and I think there's also a list of the sections and stuff like that if you go on to, like, the Wikipedia page for Ulysses.
Yeah, no, I knew. I have a list of the sections from Cliff Notes, but for some reason I didn't put together that that's where they – because I was just like, okay, because sections, right, were put in later. They weren't broken up by him or they weren't named
by him. Well, I think when they were originally serialized, they were – that was the title of the section that was serialized. So, you know – the first thing that was published was the Nestor section, you know, and that was what it was titled when it appeared in, you know, the Little Review and places like that. And and so on, because I think they got through a total of 13. Yeah, they got through a total of 13 sections before it was banned. Section 13 being Nausicaa, where Bloom is supposed to, you know, jerk off to the woman on the beach.
Oh.
Right. So, yeah.
I'm sure that takes 50 pages for him to jerk off.
I'm sure.
Yeah, so I have this. Joyce, of course, did not divide the novel into numbered or titled chapters, but for the sake of reference and clarity, these commentaries have been labeled according to the standard divisions by Stuart Gilbert.
Right.
So, yeah. So that was the person who serialized it, who published it?
No, that would have been someone who was probably in charge of one of the early editions.
Okay.
Or one of the interpretations. So, yeah. Yeah.
So how did you do with it? Like how?
Well, okay. So the sections that are from the point of view of Stephen Bloom, which are the first three.
Leopold.
No, from Stephen Dedalus. The first three ones are him. So that's Telemachus, Nestor, and Proteus, which are that first section. I really struggled with those. I mean, I've read stuff that's done in stream of consciousness before. Of course, I think everybody has to one extent or another, but
it comes in and out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it doesn't seem very controlled to me, but
no.
I understand he did this with intent. So there's a part of me that's reading this and I keep thinking to myself, this is the genesis of every bad piece of hipster lit I've read since I got out of graduate school. You know, everybody trying to do what Joyce did, and they're so in love with Joyce, so they're trying to do their own version of it. And my impression after reading those first three sections to the Stephen Dedalus thing, it was that it's all bad. You know?
So just to be clear, those first three sections that are in Stephen's voice, they're up to that is book one.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. All right.
Yep. And, you know, so I had got done reading all of our required sections for this one. And the only section that I felt like I had a handle on and could follow and made any kind of, I guess you'd say even artistic sense, was the section where it's broken up by the newspaper headlines.
Oh, God. See, and that's the section I had the biggest problem with.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. I didn't know what those headlines were. Yeah. Like that was where I got. Yeah. That's funny. So what about that was easier for you?
Well, it actually seemed despite the breakup of the headlines gave it, it actually followed a more logical kind of story structure. Mm-hmm. I got, because there was action, because there were people interacting with each other, you know, actual dialogue going on, then those moments where you slipped out into the narrator's voice, you know, filling in information and giving you, you know, the physicality and the logistics of the people in the room, I was able to keep those things separate and different. Mm-hmm. And therefore it read more like a traditional story for me. Whereas, you know, the way Joyce is doing the stream of consciousness, particularly with the Stephen Dedalus parts, because he descends so far into abstraction, my brain wants to identify who is speaking, who's controlling the flow of information. And you know that feeling you get when some kind of amateur is running a video camera and they keep zooming the focus in and out and in and out real fast, and that coming into focus at a distance and blurring in real close and all of that. That's what that reminds me of, and it makes me nauseous when I see that on video. And it kind of did that to me in the text here, because it's going in real close on Daedalus's, you know, what he's thinking, to the point where there's using the first person eye, and then it zooms back out to, you know, Joyce's, you know, idealized narrator, and then it zooms back in, and it's just flipping sometimes in the span of a sentence or a few words. And it was tedious going, and I and yeah, I had an easier time with the Leo Bloom sections because he wasn't as abstract. He was a bit more grounded on what was in front of him and not suddenly descending into, you know, philosophy and poetry. And so.
And there's a lot that, right, and there's a lot that, well, there's a lot of, like, musing about being a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more Stephen, I think.
Yeah.
Because Stephen's a writer.
Yep.
Yeah, and then Leopold Bloom, that takes us through to where we ended, right? He's that, is he that whole that whole thing?
Yep.
And okay, so I was not wrong about that when I said, oh, okay. So I thought that was me screwing it up. I didn't. Okay. So
yeah, the only time we really leave Bloom's point of view is with the newspaper scene. The section where they're in the newspaper offices and we keep getting those headlines. That actually has a nice, you know, deep authorial distance where he's just reporting the events. And
but these newspaper headlines are actual headlines.
Well, they're written like headlines just for the section of the dialogue that's happening there. So it's like, let's see. Well, oh, we're the section where it's KMRIA. It's about page 147, just above 145 in the parenthetical number. Yeah. And it finally dawned on me about halfway through that somehow the title is tied to what that section is. And of course, KMRI and KMA,
yeah, kiss my royal eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I was like, you know, that's kind of when it started. I mean, what's when I knew the headlines were somehow related to what was happening in the dialogue, but those were kind of the nakedly obvious ones. But yeah, so you're not really getting Leo's point of view on that or Stephen's, because they're both out of the office at the time. It's just Joyce doing this thing. Like I said, those sections were a relief after the first six. Because
the other thing is there's a lot more white space too.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, in a way, it was relief just because there was less words on the page and it's so dense. yeah, so I'm reconsidering how I should be reading this so I can actually follow the narrative. The other thing was, last night I went through and I kind of went through all my notes and kind of did a little, took some notes in my notebook. And then, you know, they go to the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me, I didn't know who was dead. Like, when they first went to the funeral, I thought it was Stephen's mother.
Right.
Because they talk about her dying. And then I went through and I identified three other dead people. I mean, there are probably several dead people, but I identified three other deaths that they're talking about. Uh-huh. And I think finally they say, they name whose funeral it is.
Right.
But it was... on 157, they say it's Dingham.
Yep.
And I think he comes in earlier too, but then there was someone named Patty and then someone named Parnell.
Mm-hmm.
And because, and those might have just been because, you know, people are, as people do, having conversations that remind them of other things and thinking of other things. So a lot of times it's looping in memories and all sorts of stuff that it took me like, I couldn't figure out who the dead person was, you know, they seem to spend very much time on him.
Right. Yeah. No, well, I think that was kind of the point, you know, in some of the, cause like I said, when I got, except for the newspaper headline section, I was struggling to make much sense of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, Joyce was trying to, you know, get at that rather, I guess the best way to describe it is, you know, I've been to quite a few funerals.
Yeah.
And I'm generally not thinking about the dead person, you know, through there, you know, at my own, who was it? It was one of my aunts by marriage, her father had died.
Uh-huh.
So someone I'm not really technically related to. And I was at that funeral and I remember sitting through that whole thing, just kind of you know, waiting for it to be over with so I could quit listening to all of these cliches about how much he loved life and loved his family. Nobody said anything, you know, nakedly earnest. Mm-hmm. They were obviously grieving and in pain, and you kind of had to see that. You could see that humanity, but they could not get out an expression of that that wasn't horribly cliched.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell that story because I think that's what Joyce was trying to get to with Bloom's narrative through the funeral thing, is that he's kind of removed from that, the dead guy, to a certain extent. He's shown up to show his respects, but he can't really connect emotionally because it's not his, you know, it wouldn't be his wife or his daughter, you know, who had died and stuff like that. And so he's thinking about all these other things while acting somber. And
by the way, it looks like Patty Dingham is Patty. Patty is his first name.
Okay.
Okay.
So yeah, I think that's what he was trying to do, was to, you know, create that disconnect for the reader about what's actually going on at a funeral.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. So,
but I had to reach for that one at first because I was like, okay, yeah, I got it, and as I was, you know, trying to sort out what sections we had read, you know, as far as their relation to the Odyssey. You know, that's where I got that. That's where I went back and I just happened to catch that in a line, you know, about, you know, that section, that it was this kind of remove from the performance from the of emotion.
Yeah. Did you, oh God, I forgot what I was going to ask. Cause I'm trying to figure out the sections, like where the sections are. And it looks like Alias is where the newspaper headlines are.
Right.
So I lost one. I thought I was marking them correctly, but I guess I'm not. I missed Hades.
Right. That was the funeral.
Do you know where it starts?
Let me see here. That's actually when they're.
Like, do you know what number it is?
Oh, yeah. Just give me a second here. It would have been roughly around 99 or 100 is when it started, because that's when they get to the cemetery.
Okay.
And they're actually, you know, watching the gravediggers do their job.
Okay, but there's no break there.
Right. There's no break for Hades.
Okay. All right.
Because then it's about 114, in the 115, 114, where it switches to,
the newspaper type,
the newspaper bit, which would be,
Aeolus.
Yeah. Aeolus or whatever that is.
All right.
So, yeah. And I'm having to really, I guess this is where it comes in handy to have someone who's a Joyce scholar, or maybe to go and grab, you know, something like Spark Notes or Cliff Notes to point out some stuff, you know, and
good.
Not to go and read it and be told what it is, but to at least get a handle on it, you know, because I think that's what a professor is, if you were taking a class on Ulysses, would do, is like give you enough to get so that you get a handle on it, because this is so dense. I think there's too much of an inclination. And this is something else that's kind of, this is my meta commentary on this. There's part of me after reading this and then just what little I skimmed trying to get what the sections were, is that to me, this seems like the source of the tendency for literature classes to be taught badly.
Right? You mean the book, Ulysses, is the source?
Yeah. Because he set out, you know, when I watched that little video about Joyce and read the article as we were getting ready for it, you know, his intent of putting all of these references in there and all of these allusions to stuff and with the intent of giving the lit professor something to dwell on for centuries, he was so successful at doing that. Obviously a very intelligent guy. I'm not trying to knock Joyce's intelligence or whatever, but he was so successful at doing this that it gives the impression, because people are so dedicated and so in love with finding all the allusions and all the meanings, and because there's no significant plot. There's nothing at stake. This is just, you know, an hour by hour, you know, accounting of one day.
Mm-hmm.
It then takes the act of interpreting and the relationship that normally happens between a reader and a book and does remove almost the act of individual interpretation and says, no, this means this. This is related to Odysseus. This is related to the Odyssey. This is related to Shakespeare. And it just becomes an exercise in identifying the references and going, ah, bing. And when you start teaching literature that way, other literature that's not Ulysses, then it gets people into that thing that there's one right way or one proper way to interpret what's in a text.
Mm-hmm.
Because Joyce was so prescriptive about what he was putting in the text.
Well, it also, I mean, it completely, did you look up all the, I mean, you can't look up all of them because there's so many of them, but like I looked up stuff as I came across it when I was able to.
Yeah.
And it's very diverse.
Right.
The stuff he has in there. And in one part it's interesting because I mean, I can't remember in what context they all come up, but I know mm-hmm. at least some of them come up because they're referenced by the people speaking.
Right, right. There's so a lot of reference to Hamlet. So there,
and I can buy that. And you know, there's stuff like in Sanskrit and there's... I took some notes on some of them, but like some of them... So, and I don't remember like who said which ones, mm-hmm, obviously, mm-hmm. but it does have... If you're going to have characters reference these things, it has to be believable that these characters would know these things.
Right.
And I didn't pay too much attention to that, but there's a lot of stuff in there. so it ends up being, yeah, you're not reading this. You're not reading this like you would read a book that you're trying to like sit and enjoy and get the narrative. This ends up being an exercise.
Right.
In all of these things, it's like reading an encyclopedia or something, or something with a lot of footnotes.
Right, right.
And that experience, like I toyed yesterday with in the last few days, like, do I read the Cliff Notes? Do I just go through the parts that we read
mm-hmm.
and to find out what the plot was? And I decided not to. I'm sure in large part from laziness, because it would have taken up more time. But also, when you and I had this conversation, right. I wanted at least for the first time to have come to it with an authentic experience of having read this thing naively.
Right. Exactly.
And I felt like if I did the Cliff Notes, I could have just read the Cliff Notes and not read the book.
Right.
I
mean, right.
Sort of. And anybody can do that. So I was afraid that if I got through the Cliff Notes, it would have taken away to a certain extent
right.
This experience. And on the other hand, I could still talk about what a slog it was to get through it and then read the Cliff Notes and be like, and now I know who the dead person is.
Right, right.
So I don't know. Like, so that's something I'm kind of thinking about going through, because this could, I mean, we took 2 weeks to read, you know, a little over 150 pages.
Yep.
If I wanted to like research everything in here, I would have to take vacation time from work. I mean, it's, you know, like yeah. really, like yeah. it is.
No.
And so I guess like one of the things that, you know, I want to think about with you is kind of like, what's the best way to get through it
mm-hmm.
in a way that's going to be meaningful. Like, I definitely feel like I want to get a better handle on the narrative.
Right, right.
That's why, like, I'm going to, like, see if I can read this entire thing at home in front of my computer where I can easily, like, reference stuff. And that's going to make it take a lot longer.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I got into the next section that we're going to start reading for next time, I kind of picked it up. And that is what I found. I don't know if you did this, but I found myself doing it a lot. And I sometimes took notes on this, which was that, I know what's happening. I know what's happening. A lot of times dialogue would help me know what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, concrete action would let me know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would kind of lose it. And I know on some level I was tuning out because I was waiting for the marker or whatever for the concrete thing that was going to pull me back in.
Right,
and,
right.
Yeah, and I don't want to read it that way. I think it's a waste to read it that way, and I'm probably missing stuff in the narrative and all sorts of stuff.
Right.
Because there is a lot of, like, really great language in here. There's use of rhyme. There's use of nursery rhymes. There's all sorts of, like, rhythm and...
Yeah, I'm sure you noticed that probably more than I do. I mean, that's... I've noticed I was doing the exact same thing, is that, you know, looking for the, waiting for the concrete action, for the dialogue, for that, you know, to actually have him say, you know, have some line pass, then him go, so-and-so said, and I'd be like, oh, okay, I'm back in.
Yeah, come back on now. Yeah.
Back on the horse. Now let's go until I fall off again. And, you know, and I think part of my struggles is that I'm more story dependent than language dependent. Although I do notice those times when the language starts to get very inventive and hits a certain rhythmic and a pattern, because I do look for that. I mean, those are the writers that do that well are some of the writers that I admire the most, like Ondaatje and stuff like that, who are very attuned to the rhythm and the pattern of the language itself, separate from the narrative, and they somehow get them to work together.
Yeah, but you know what Ondaatje is saying when he says
it. Yeah. There's a part of me, I mean, I think my rule, the way I'm going to approach the reading is I know that I'm already biased against the book because of my particular reaction to what, you know, people say. If somebody says, oh, you know, you've got to do this, my immediate thing is to resist, mm-hmm. resist. And so I know that there's that bias already in place, you know, for this book. But I think I want to approach my reading of it as much as possible in the same way that someone who didn't know Joyce, who was reading it serialized or picked up the book for the first time, you know, in 1938, would be reading it, where they would be struggling to connect all of the references, to do all that stuff. That's kind of how I want to experience it. And then go back after I finish the section and take a look at, you know, somebody's notes, like a Cliff Notes or a Spark Notes or something like that, and go, okay, what did I miss? How
did you do that this time? Did you go back and
I didn't read the notes in detail. I just looked for the section headings and kind of skimmed I'm skimming the Spark Notes, just kind of like going, oh, that's what I missed. Like what I missed entirely, what I saw in here was like, apparently Bloom has a lucky potato. Did you catch that?
No.
Yeah.
About a handkerchief or a tissue at the beginning.
Right.
There's a whole thing about a tissue, but no, when is there a potato?
Yeah, like, I don't know. I might have to go back and find that out. But yeah, it was something, you know, during the scene where he's making breakfast for his wife.
Okay. No, I remember
And before he goes out to the latrine. And that's the other thing. I was like going, this is where my brain goes, okay? I was like, I was very impressed. We have a very artistic description of a bowel movement.
Yes, I do remember that.
But when did he wash his hands? When did he wash his hands?
He probably didn't.
You know, that's the thing that, so like, you know, for like 5 pages after this artful description of a bowel movement, I'm going, wash your hands, dude. Wash your fucking hands.
Hey, this thing was on trial for obscenity. No one has to wash their hands. He's not going to wash his hands when he masturbates for 50 pages either. Now I'm like getting, yeah.
Yeah, but I completely missed this, you know, talismanic potato thing, so.
Wow. Well, I'm very interested in getting all the sections right. And yeah, I do, so yeah, so what I'm thinking is, and part of it too is I had like another thing I was doing in the evening these last couple of weeks, some training I'm doing. So this, and I just have things going on in the evening, but I'm going to try to like, the other thing is when we started this, I'm like, I wonder if I have to give up writing for the next 10 weeks.
Right.
To a certain extent, because like what I will do now after I do this is I'll go to the cafe and I'll work on my own writing. And for a while I'm just, wow, I wonder if I just won't have time to do that because I'm reading friggin' Ulysses and I need to like have my, I have to, you know, I would rather not give up my writing for the
right.
until, you know, April or whenever it is.
No, I'm still managing to do a little bit of writing. I'm not, I'm just keeping it to my morning, you know, hour or 2 hours before I go to work. And then the rest of the day it's all Ulysses when I can squeeze it in at lunch or after work. But yeah, I'm going to have to up my game a little bit on the reading time because, you know, it was easy to spot the references to Hamlet. It was easy to spot some references to history, but I realized that, you know, I was specifically looking for things that tied it to the Odyssey.
Did you read the Odyssey?
Yeah.
Do you know it? Yeah, okay.
But I realized that it's been so long since I read the Odyssey that I'm not catching all of the references that I probably should be catching.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's a thing in the newspaper section, one of the notes that I skimmed across was that there's some aspect about the wind and stuff like that, and how the wind appears, or it's written about in the Odyssey, and then all of the wind blowing and stuff like this in the newspaper room, and I didn't catch any of that at all. Right. The only references I think I really caught to the Odyssey and were the few times where they made reference to like the wine dark sea and played on that phrase for a while since that was, I think, in one of the opening sections of the Odyssey. It was one of the more vivid images from the Odyssey that stuck in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, part of me is thinking I might have to keep the Odyssey. I had the Odyssey out for a while and was debating whether or not to skim it in tandem with Ulysses, and I just might have to do it.
I can tell you I will not be doing that. What I am doing, and for no particular reason whatsoever, just to be cute, is that I am writing my notes in different color pens according to what section we're on. So I was on my purple pen, and now I'm on my green pen.
Right.
And I'm not doing that. And it doesn't help me at all, except one day I'll look back at this and I'll know like what sections we did.
But no, I mean, yeah, it was, like I said, yeah, I'm still kind of in the dark and struggling to get a handle on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not improving my opinion of all the people who praised it and say, you need to read it, you know?
Well, you know, and you said earlier a similar thing that I said the other day, which was kind of like so many times, and this is not to say that I would execute this as well as Joyce, obviously I wouldn't, but like, I feel like when these type of things are attempted, even if there was someone who was good, right, at this,
right.
You bring this into a workshop, people would be like, what the hell are you doing?
Right.
Even if it's executed well. And I have that reaction a lot when people do like experimental stuff is like eventually, you know, are people just squeamish about like experimental stuff or I mean, there's obviously a way to do this worse, right? There's a way to not do this.
Oh yeah.
But you know, this could be bad. I don't know. And it's interesting too, because I don't know enough. I mean, this is something you could probably tell me much better, you know, because they keep saying this is like in the modernist era, although apparently Julia Kristeva, who I was reading with friends of mine and it was in part of the bio I put together, was saying she called it like postmodernism. And right. I always thought of modernism as being very like kind of steeped in form, like traditional, not traditional forms, but like keeping informed, but this is not doing that. But I probably don't have a very good handle on modernism versus postmodernism.
Yeah. Well, modernism was a reaction to late 19th century realism. You know, like your Jack London and things like this, but also in a way kind of Twain and stuff like this, where the language was very florid and they spent a lot of time giving you all this backstory and detailed descriptions and settings. And I've often, one of the ways I've often described it is that what you had prior to modernism was, in a sense, you would pick up a book and it would be this intellectual, imaginative experience like a train ride. It progressed at a steady pace. You would sit on your window and you would watch the landscape slowly come up to you and approach and pass by and go on. And that was about the speed of it. and you could watch the season and the landscape change, and you could see clearly the town and the faces and the people and stuff on it. By the time you get to the modernists, you don't have – what you have is the beginning of that erasure of distance. And so what the modernists are doing is they're stripping out all that florid stuff and saying what's most important is people are aware of, because at this point, you know, photography was more prevalent. We didn't have TV at the time of the modernists, but you had radio. You had trains were getting faster. You didn't have flight, but they were wanting to strip out that pastoral, you know, let's describe the landscape and instead focus on this interaction between people.
Mm-hmm. And more internal too.
And a bit more internal, but also, you know, at the same time, you know, so they're wanting to strip out, you know, that, well, in a way they wanted to strip out the writer and just get down to the story. Whereas, you know, Twain and everything, that's a lot of that is the writer.
Mm-hmm.
And then postmodernism is this, it's this combined thing that everything means everything and nothing means nothing. And Donald Duck is equally important as Mozart, as far as cultural reference point goes. And you become conscious of the act of telling the story when you tell the story, and that the line between the writer and the fiction and the reader is crooked at best, non-existent at worst. And so you can just violate it and go whatever and do whatever and say whatever you want. And, you know, there's Ulysses at sometimes can be postmodernist in that it's doing things, it's mixing styles and approaches and forms and mushing it all together. But at the same time, it's hinting at postmodernism in the same way that Don Quixote does. Because if you go back, I don't know if you've ever read Don Quixote. I've read parts of it. I've never gotten around to finishing it. I'm wandering around in Don Quixote like most people do. And if you take a look at Don Quixote, every single literary form that you could think of is also in there. There's the epistolary story where it's happening in letters and it's happening in first person. They've got third person stuff. They've got all this other stuff going on in there. And I guess, you know, if basically what postmodernism is, I guess, is the acknowledgement that nothing is new and everything is new, and so none of it matters.
Mm-hmm.
And so do whatever you want. But that all has touchstones back with Joyce and just goes back to Don Quixote. And so there's the distinctions between, like, the era of literature that was Don Quixote and the era that was Mark Twain and Jack London, and the era that was Hemingway and Faulkner and Joyce and that, and then the era that was, you know, the Beats, the Kerouac, and then the postmodernists like, oh, shit. He wrote a book called Spanking, Robert Coover.
Oh, I don't know him at all.
Yeah, he wrote a book, several books, but the one of his that I read and got a kick out of was Spanking the Maid. And it basically just tells the same event over and over again with subtle changes until, well, the first event is the maid comes in and opens up the room in the morning for the man she works for. And, you know, it's slightly erotic. He ends up spanking her and punishing her for doing something wrong. And then over time, as the story subtly changes, as he keeps retelling the same scene again and again, by the end of the book, she's spanking him and she's in charge, right? So yeah, it's playing with form and manipulating it, and I forget where I'm going with all this. But yeah, so there's...
I asked you about postmodernism and modernism in terms of Joyce, in terms of Ulysses.
Yeah, so he's a modernist because he's getting rid of that kind of Baroque, pastoral, confident, authorial thing, and he's just erasing all of that and going with the stream of consciousness and the event and the reality, and this is what's now and modern, as opposed to removed or prosaic or anything. And it's most of your postmodernists probably were big fans of Joyce, as far as I know, but I don't know.
And you've never read anything else from him, correct?
Joyce? No. Like I said, I've been avoiding Joyce.
Oh, you've avoided him altogether.
Yeah. I mean, Laura, Holly, our friend from grad school, she has been trying to get me to read, I think it's the story collection, The Dubliners.
Yeah.
I think that's one of like her, she's always said that was one of her favorite story collections. And I kind of, I'm like going, okay, fine, I'll get around to it. But every time, you know, the topic of Joyce comes up around people, I always get, oh, have you read Ulysses yet? You've got to read Ulysses. I'm like, oh, no.
It's so funny because when I was talking to people about reading it, they're like, oh, it's not too bad, you know, in terms of the difficulty of it.
Right.
And my friend was just like, you know, you just have to, she's a fiction writer, but she's like, you know, you just have to like sink into it. Just get some wine. And just let it, you know, and like, I think about that as I'm reading this and I'm like, I can't drink wine. What am I going to say during the podcast? I'm already confused. Like I need all my faculties. I can't be buzzed with Ulysses. And so if I was doing another type of reading, maybe the wine and cheese and Ulysses would be a nice thing. But like,
well, you got to try it at least once while we're doing this.
Well, I'm going to her house tomorrow to write, which means talk. Mm-hmm. So I can bring the book. I'll section off Delia was drinking here. And,
well, just as an experiment, you know, I think that might be something to try with one of our sections is, you know, we make sure that, you know, what is it? where's my breakdown here? Oh, like, you know, either before we talk about section two or before section three is that we make sure we read that section, you know, with
intoxicated
or on the road to intoxication. Okay. And see if that changes anything.
Because right now we're in the Lestragonians, right?
Right.
That's the section we're in right now.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. So this is, so I have this right so far.
Yep. Yep. And I think I like the idea of leaving off in the middle of something, kind of the same rule of writing that I try to follow, which is, you know, in the morning before I hop off into the shower, I try to stop in the middle of a sentence or in the middle of a scene.
Do you really?
Or something. Right. So that there's something left to think about throughout the day. Otherwise it's just like, peters off. So
yeah. Oh, interesting.
Approaching the story that way. Can't leave a section unfinished.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't dislike anything that we've read so far. I'm struggling with it, which I like the challenge. I like the fact that it's not easy, you know, and that he's, and I have to respect the fact that, you know, unlike a number of popular writers today, Joyce is definitely not trying to insult your intelligence by,
no.
He's expecting you to keep up. And to get it. And that's refreshing, you know? Mm-hmm. they're, and of course, you know, I always suspect I'm a little bit less than intelligent, so.
Well, then you're reading the perfect book. This is right. This book is not good for the self-esteem, definitely.
No, definitely not.
I'm trying to see, because I took a bunch of notes in pink pen. Yeah, so a lot of things I already said, which is about Cliff Notes and about where I am when I read.
I'll come up with a better description of the difference between modernism and postmodernism for the next one.
You know, I'm so horrible with that stuff. Like I've never, you know, when we were at Naropa, my thing was I realized after the fact, everybody talked about it, but no one ever explained it. It's like everybody went in thinking everybody understood it. And I never had the presence of mind to be like, hey, would you tell me what the hell you're talking about? And I actually just read this book. It's animated. It's a cartoon of critical theory. Mm-hmm. And even that didn't really do a great job of explaining it. And I don't know why it is that as much as I've had these conversations, it's not something I know.
Right. Right.
You know?
Well, maybe we'll start off the next one with a little discussion of what modernism and postmodernism are, just to make sure that you and I and everybody who's listening to us kind of is on the same groundwork.
Yeah.
You know, because like I said, my as an undergrad, my focus was 20th century American modernism. You know, so I read Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald and, you know, like things like Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, who, you know, that was genre stuff, the detective stuff, but it falls in with that same crowd. They were part of that same group in a way. American modernism is not drastically different, but significantly different than particularly British and European modernism, which would have been people like Joyce. And who else? Well, I guess even Gertrude Stein, even though she's American, she's definitely fits in more with the European modernists.
Really?
And same thing with Ezra Pound. Well, Stein and Pound spent way more time in Paris and in France than Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And of course, Faulkner never spent time, you know, with the expats, but he's lumped in with the modernists. And his Southern modernism is very different than Fitzgerald and Hemingway. So
T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, T.S. Eliot would have been, well, he was American, but he...
Oh, was he really? I thought he was British.
Well, he immigrated and I think converted to the Anglican faith and spent the rest of his life and died in England.
Mm.
I have to go back and check on that. So yeah, no, and even when I was... Even though I focused on 20th century American modernism, I don't know that we ever really, as an undergrad or even as a graduate, there was much discussion on what the difference was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's probably a huge gap in our education. Huge. So we're probably admitting way too much shameful information for the world in here.
That's it. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I don't have, like, I know what I like and I know what I read and I've read a ton, but I don't, that whole, like, overview thing, historical, I never learned it. No one ever taught it to me.
Right,
It wasn't taught in Europa.
Yeah.
At least in the classes I took.
Yeah, it was hinted at in a few of the things that I took. And it seems like that's really more of the kind of thing that if you're majoring in lit studies that you spend more time thinking on than if you're majoring or doing creative writing.
Yeah.
You're just, because, you know, as a writer, I do have some concern about my literary lineage. I like to know who influenced the writers I know. And then I want to know who influenced those writers.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go back and you take a look at the writers who influenced the writers you like, it's not that whole distinction between postmodernism and modernism and realism and all that stuff just blurs entirely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Beats loved, you know, William Carlos Williams and the poets. They liked and Rimbaud, and they just went all over the place. Impressionists, and you take a look at even the modernists and Hemingway, and he was as much influenced by painting as he was by other writers.
Mm-hmm.
Man, writers are more concerned with inspiration and generalization than they are with that kind of weird delineation of class and genre. And I think that's the better place to be. Mm-hmm. Unless you're trying to make a career out of a little niche thing. That's my defense of our ignorance.
All right. Have we sufficiently...
I think we've...
Have we sufficiently beat up Joyce? Or had him, or talked about him beating us up?
So I will write up a little definition of modernism and postmodernism for the next one, and we're reading two pages to 306 from the 1938 edition there in the margin for the next one.
I already marked it out with green pen.
Sweet. Well, I'm gonna.
So and it's almost precisely the same amount of pages.
Yep.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, I'm gonna sign off, but don't go anywhere.
Okay.